Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Okay, brace yourself. Today's show is going to get really intimate. We're talking about babies and giving birth. We'll learn the struggles for our grandmothers and even great-grandmothers.
Birth has always been right on the cusp of life and death. You know, a baby's not there and then it's alive and it's with you. But mothers died from hemorrhage and we didn't have IVs.
We'll hear from a midwife who started delivering babies in the early 1970s.
At that time in history, women were going to hospitals and actually being tied down to the table by their wrists, and their legs were in big stirrups.
Today, hospital births aren't quite so intense, but some women still choose home births over hospitals. But what's it like to have a baby at home? Well,
push.
He's coming, baby.
Yeah, grab some tissues, I'm telling you, as we go on a journey with some midwives, some mamas, and more inside Appalachia. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. This week, our show is all about women, and women having babies. These rugged mountains can create some interesting birthing situations. That's been true a long time. It used to be that women typically gave birth in home-like environments. Today, most women head to the hospital, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that across the U.S., one in every three mothers has a cesarean delivery. Well, there's a movement afoot to swing away from medical models. Many say that movement was fostered right here in these hills years ago. More and more women seem to want to reclaim this ancient rite of passage as their own by having their babies at home. According to the CDC, across the nation, the number of women giving birth to babies at home or at a birthing center increased nearly 30% between 2004 and 2009. But researchers in Oregon did find that home births are riskier than having a baby at a hospital. Aside from the mother, probably one of the most important roles for these births is a midwife. Today's show is all about the miracle of life and the women who dedicate their lives to assisting in that journey to existence. We're going to find out more about home births and more about midwifery in Appalachia. So hang on to your seats. We'll start with a look back at the role of midwives in Appalachia. Patricia Harmon is an author and a retired certified nurse midwife who's written some compelling historical fiction about what it was like to be a midwife in Appalachia in the 1930s. Here's an excerpt from her book, The Midwife of Hope River. The scene takes place in a coal camp in West Virginia during the Great Depression. Our colleague at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, Glynis Board, is reading this passage from Harmon's novel.
The mother, Delena, takes a deep breath and strains down again. We don't wait for another pain, afraid if she stops, the head will slip back. The children push their mother up a little higher each time, and Izzy, with the wisdom of a gentleman, keeps the head steady. He knows he can't shove this baby out, though no doubt he would like to. With each maternal effort, I feel the skull lower. I could check the baby's heartbeat, but that would take time, and besides, what would I do if the heart rate dropped? There wouldn't be time to get to a hospital, not on these dirt roads with nothing but a burro to ride on. No, we keep on.
In this scene, Patience Murphy, the midwife, has been called to assist an Italian-speaking mother who's struggling to give birth. The midwife has to work through an English interpreter, her daughter, to coach the mother through the delivery. And then,
the newborn is already scrunching up his face, a good sign. I wipe its mouth with a clean piece of rag. Last push! The baby spins three times as a cord at least 3 feet long unwraps around his chest, and a little boy falls into my lap. Now we are all laughing and crying. Language doesn't mean anything in the presence of true joy.
Again, that was an excerpt from a novel by Patricia Harmon called The Midwife of Hope River. Harmon says giving birth used to be much more dangerous for women and babies than it is today.
Birth has always been, right on the cusp of life and death. You know, a baby's not there and then it's alive and it's with you. But mothers died from hemorrhage and we didn't have IVs. In the 1930s, most hospitals didn't have IVs. There weren't medications that could make the bleeding stop. There weren't antibiotics if a person got childbed fever.
Patricia's books are set in Appalachia, a place where, traditionally, women have had to rise above many challenges.
So mothers died and babies died. And in rural areas that were impoverished and the women didn't have good health, it must have been worse. So like in 1930, 1 out of 10 babies died. That's 10%. So you could see why people did not look forward to childbirth as some kind of like carefree experience. I mean, their lives were in danger and the outcome for babies wasn't always good. Interestingly, hospitals in those days were not that much better. The germ theory was just getting acknowledged. So often, the rates of infection might be higher in hospitals than at home. And some women preferred home for that reason. They felt like to go to the hospital was scarier than to stay home and have a baby. And other women were the opposite. You know, it was the modern thing. You know, there were more affluent women who considered that to be the very best of care.
Patricia found that back in 1925, West Virginia had an interesting law about midwifery.
Before that, you didn't even have to call yourself a midwife. You were just grandma or something. And you would go, the people would call you when it was time, and you would go to their house and deliver their baby. But after 1925, West Virginia felt that some of the maternal and perinatal morbidity, in other words, the bad complications, were being caused by midwives. This was never proved, and a lot of people felt the doctors were just kind of putting it off on the midwives. But the state legislature did decide they needed some regulation. But the interesting thing about the midwifery law of 1925 was it was so simple. All you had to do was register, be able to read, have a clean house. I guess they would send a nurse or somebody to your from the health department to check your house. Have some kind of birth kit that was clean and tidy. And you had to be of good moral character. And that one always cracked me up because I was thinking, oh, how would they know that? You know, just reputation. I think you also had to have a physician or someone in the area vouch for you. And you were not allowed to do vaginal exams, which I think is really incredible because sometimes you really need to do them to figure out, is it the baby coming foot first or head first? But it was against the law for a midwife to do that. Of course, my heroine in my books always broke the law. She was kind of a rebel.
Again, that was Patricia Harmon, the author of several books and articles about midwifery, including memoirs and 2 historical novels. Her most recent novel is called The Reluctant Midwife. You can hear an extended version of this conversation with Harmon on our website at wvpublic.org. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to visit a place that's considered the birthplace of modern midwifery, and it's right here in Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. So, in home birthing circles, there's a famous midwife named Ina Mae Gaskin who is revered for pioneering natural childbirthing practices in this country. She wrote a book now known around the globe called Spiritual Midwifery. Mostly, it's a compilation of natural childbirth stories that happened right here in Appalachia at this earth-crunchy baby birthing place founded by Ina May in Tennessee in the early 70s called the Farm Midwifery Center. 45 years, a dozen books, and more than 2,690 babies later, the farm is still going strong. And we happen to know one young woman who knows the place intimately, and she happens to be our producer, Roxy Todd. Roxy lived there as a very young baby and recently revisited the place to bring us this very special story.
We left the farm when I was still 6 months old. My parents and I moved out to a little pink house in the suburbs of Nashville, where nobody I knew ate tofu. And just about everyone went to the big Baptist church out along the highway. It was a place where it was not cool to listen to hippie music, or eat weird hippie food, or dress in anything but mall clothes. So my parents hung up their homemade paisley outfits in the back of their closet, and I kept the farm part of my history a secret from most of my friends. Maybe I was a little bit embarrassed that I'd been born on a hippie commune and that my first home was a remodeled school bus. There. So now you know more about me than I ever expected telling a few thousand radio listeners. But to tell this story, I decided that I needed to go back to my early beginnings. And I brought my mom with me. Her name is Karen.
This is the spot where I think our school bus used to be. We lived in the school bus and it had a bed, but for the summer we had a waterbed outside and a canopy over it and used to sleep out there. And then when we had you, Roxy, you had a little cradle out there with a mosquito netting over it, and you used to live in the woods and listen to the sounds and the animal sounds. And
see, we really were hippies. I wasn't joking. The spot my mom is pointing out, where we had our school bus 32 years ago, is now overgrown with trees and grass. She moved back to the farm a few years ago, and I visited her back in February. That's when my mom told me a story that I'd never heard before. It was around the point in her pregnancy when I was 2 weeks overdue, and she felt ready to burst. On a path near a schoolhouse, she ran into a deer family in the woods.
The mother was really pregnant with a fawn, and she wasn't afraid of me because we looked at each other, and I was really pregnant, and she was really pregnant. She wasn't afraid of me, I could tell, and we just had something in common. We could tell we were both in the same boat.
I was born a week after this staring contest with the pregnant deer. Walking further down that path, we come to the house of Pamela Hunt. She's one of the original midwives here, and she was part of the first group who settled the farm in 1971.
Come on in.
If you ever come to my house again, don't politely knock on the door. We'll never hear you. Come in and holler for us.
The air inside Pamela's house smelled like wood smoke and roses. Pamela's porch had been converted into a mini greenhouse and was full of begonias and fuchsia. A rose bush was growing in the translucent light. In the main room, there was a corner full of children's toys, and books were tucked into the walls. This was definitely a room with a handful of little nooks and crannies that looked like perfect places to curl up and read. The three of us sat at a wooden table, and Pamela handed us each a glass of water, and she started to tell us about why she became a midwife 45 years ago.
We developed our midwifery system to be able to be self-sufficient to deliver our own babies, and we wanted to be safe about it.
Pamela and the midwives also wanted to help give other women an alternative to hospitals. It was the 1960s and 70s, and not many women were having home births.
At that time in history, women were going to hospitals and actually being strapped down to the table, tied down to the table, like by their wrists and their legs were in big stirrups, and they actually, you know, so, and they wouldn't let women get up and walk around, and they wouldn't let their husbands be there.
Back in California, where Pamela was born and raised, a couple who were friends of hers and about to give birth actually handcuffed themselves together
and went into the hospital and said, we're going to be together for this birth. We just wanted to let you know. So they walked in handcuffed, you know. We were like the hippies of San Francisco. And I think that we just took a stand and said, you know, we're not going to go with the establishment here. We want to have our babies the way we want to have them.
Another one of Pamela's friends from California was Ina Mae Gaskin. Yes, the famous Ina Mae who founded the Farm Midwifery Center. Ina Mae was also the lead editor of the book Spiritual Midwifery, a book that became known around the world. And Ina Mae was one of the midwives who helped with my birth. But my mom is going to talk about what it was like to birth me in just a minute. But first, let's go back to a scene before the farm was even settled, when the group of hippies was on a caravan across the country. It was the first birth that Pamela Hunt attended.
And we were on, probably the second week of our trip after leaving San Francisco. A sweet young woman went into labor with her second baby, and her husband actually delivered the baby, but she called Ina Mae to come to help her. And Ina Mae called me. And so I went over, and this beautiful little baby was born after about a four-hour labor, and it was beautiful. I mean, they had a small bus that they were living in. They had kerosene lamps that they were using for light, and it was so there was a glow around everything. And then the sun was just sort of going down, so there was that beautiful glow in the air, you know, from the sun going down. And it just happened so easily and so well.
That first birth is what inspired Pamela and Ina Mae to learn how they could help women have their babies themselves, that they could do this.
I mean, I was pregnant myself, and I just figured I'd have the baby in the bus, no problem.
But it turned out that Pamela's first baby's birth was not that easy.
And it was a 48-hour labor, and it it didn't just fall out like I thought it would.
Though well-intentioned, Pamela realized she had a lot to learn. During the second birth that she attended, a baby was born prematurely, and somebody had to come in and do CPR to resuscitate the baby.
The bus was jam-packed with a lot of people, and it made it difficult to do what we had to do to save that baby.
The baby and the mom turned out okay, but the midwives also learned that birth was not a spectator sport. And so they stopped letting extra people into the birthing room to observe. The main thing was to make the mom feel safe and comfortable.
I think a lot of women are in the country are a little afraid of birth because what they've heard on television and what they've seen or what somebody's told them, you know, that makes them a little bit fearful. And we give them the confidence that they can do this.
Building up a relationship with the mother early on is part of how they help her have confidence.
Like if you came in, we'd talk to you in clinic, and we wouldn't just talk to you for 10 minutes. We'd probably talk to you for an hour, and we'd see what, when I do a prenatal visit with somebody, I want to hear from you, and that'll help me know how you're going to give birth. It'll just help me be able to help you better, and we build up a rapport during that time. So when you get scared, I can look in your eyes and I can say, everything's okay.
So early on, the midwives learned the importance of being trained to deal with medical emergencies.
If somebody's bleeding, we can go ahead and set up an IV and have some fluids going in that mother. And we can be giving her some oxygen. If a baby comes out and it has a hard time breathing, which sometimes happens, I mean, you don't expect it, but we've all been trained in neonatal resuscitation, and we carry the equipment we need to do that.
The midwives always attend births together, with two midwives present, just in case someone needs to be transported to the hospital or if the mother or baby needs to be resuscitated. Pamela Hunt has helped deliver 1,500 babies.
We've seen a lot of babies come out. We've seen a lot of miracles. You were one of them. You were one of those miracles.
My own birth lasted about 25 hours. There were a few complications with my position, and so at the last minute, my mom was transported to a hospital about 30 minutes away. Again, here's my mom.
I had a long labor, and it turned out she needed to be forceps turned.
Along with two of the midwives, my dad watched while the doctor delivered me with forceps.
He did cry when she came out, though. You know, he was pretty brave paramedic at the time, but that was his own child. And it sounded like she was going to break, he said, that she would come out broken.
But I didn't break. I was fine. I was delivered by Dr. Kirkendall, one of the local doctors who Pamela has been working with for years. I asked her how often something like this happens, when the midwives decide it isn't safe to deliver the baby themselves, and they take the mother to the hospital.
Not very often. If everybody's healthy, like if the mother's healthy coming up to the delivery, and we've followed her all her pregnancy and make sure she's eating right, and make sure she's getting enough exercise, and, you know, we've listened to that baby, its fetal heart tunes and everything, then we know we're going to have a good baby.
And if something doesn't look right medically, then the midwives will decide that the baby should be delivered in the hospital by one of the doctors they work with.
And I mean, occasionally something does come up, but we know how to handle it. We've been trained how to handle it.
The farm midwives do not administer any type of anesthesia during the births.
How do you help the women with the pain?
Well, different positions helps. Getting in the birth tub helps. Breathing through those last 2 centimeters. And we help them breathe through those nice deep breaths. And yeah, we just work right with you during the last part of your labor. We work right with you and make sure that you're still, you know, you're okay, that you're not scared. We don't want you to get scared.
When my mom had my younger sister, Molly, she had a shorter labor, entirely at a local hospital. It was a much more uncomfortable labor. She said they didn't let her walk around.
I experienced them making me lay down, and I was sorry I did that. You know, I didn't like being surrounded by 12 people staring at me.
During that labor, my sister was showing signs of stress, and so the doctor brought my mom into the operating room to monitor the labor. And they tried to get my mom to push her out faster and didn't let things naturally progress. My mom didn't consider returning to the farm to have her baby. She regrets that decision. But she was also in a very different place then. By the time my sister was born, we'd been living away from the farm for 3 years, and my mom was trying to be a normal suburban housewife, eat more of what most would call normal foods, dress in more normal clothes. Like me, she was leaving parts of her hippie past behind her. What I remember is our life suddenly had a lot more concrete and highways and rooms without windows, and I definitely did not sleep in a bed outside. For my mom, the difference was more intangible, a spiritual difference, she calls it. What she missed most was the farm's philosophy of natural or spiritual birth.
To honor families and honor the birthing of bringing a life into the world. I think. And it's a natural process of life that is just honored.
While at the very last minute, my mom was taken to a small rural hospital, I still think of myself as one of the thousands of babies delivered by the farm midwives. I guess I was born of both worlds, the modern hospital world and the home birth world. And I'm thankful for both. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd.
We posted a photo on our website of Roxy and her mom outside the remodeled school bus from 32 years ago. It's really precious. Go check it out at wvpublic.org. Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Lafayette Flats, vacation rentals filled with original art by local artists in historic Fayetteville, West Virginia. New River Gorge adventures begin at lafayetteflats.com. Those of you who watch the BBC show Call the Midwife might recognize this theme music. While you're looking at pictures of baby Roxy, you can also find more information about the TV series. It airs on PBS stations across the country and has done a lot to bring awareness on the subject. There are a variety of types of midwives who exist today. Some are certified, some have degrees, some certifications aren't even recognized in certain states, though. It's a complicated list, and we've outlined it for you online at wvpublic.org. Among the list are nurse midwives. They're not the most common types of midwives in the U.S. They're trained in both nursing and midwifery, and the vast majority, more than 94%, practice in hospitals. They usually have a master's or doctorate degree, as well as very specific legal requirements to follow in order to maintain licensure. In this next report, Kara Lofton tells us about a new law in West Virginia that passed in March. The law will allow experienced nurse midwives to practice independently from hospitals.
For many years, the West Virginia legislation governing nurse midwives made it really difficult for them to offer home births, even if they wanted to.
West Virginia's laws are in a status now that is creating overregulation for advanced practice nurses, and as a result, we can't practice to the fullest extent of our training and education.
That was Angie Nixon in December of 2015. Nixon is a nurse midwife who has long offered home births as part of her practice. In September, she stopped, partially because her business partner had left for another state, and partially because Nixon was required to have what's called a collaborative agreement with a physician in order to maintain licensure.
I need to name a physician with whom I collaborate and supply that physician's address and license number and such.
This physician would act as her backup in an emergency. If she doesn't have an agreement or if her physician became incapacitated for whatever reason, her license would no longer be valid. Nixon said when she first moved to West Virginia in 1999, the laws were quite progressive compared to other states. But now,
other states have gone to dropping that requirement, recognizing that as highly trained advanced practice nurses, we are fully able and capable of making decisions that don't need to be supervised or overseen by other professionals.
21 states have dropped that requirement, mostly in the Northwest. As of December, when Nixon and I spoke, all Appalachian states had some form of restrictions on the ability of nurse practitioners to practice independently. So, about 10 years ago, Nixon and other advanced practice nurses, including nurse practitioners and anesthetist, started lobbying the West Virginia legislation to change the collaborative requirement. In April of 2016, they succeeded. I caught up with Nixon a few days after the bill had passed in her home near Charleston.
So talk to me about what does this mean for you now that it's passed?
For me, it gives me a lot more options as far as practicing in West Virginia, because I can reestablish the services that I have temporarily closed at this point.
Meaning offering home births. If the legislation had not passed this year, Nixon was strongly considering leaving the state for one where she could practice midwifery more freely.
I think that initially the legislation was intended to help foster collaborations and ensure that they were occurring. And it just kind of got into what happens often in bureaucracy, is that it just got more and more interpreted to be, well, now you have to have this person listed on your license papers.
Nixon said now that the bill has passed, she is hoping she will have an easier time recruiting another midwife to her practice, who will be able to help her offer home birth services to the families that want them. Nationwide, more than 94% of nurse midwives work in hospitals, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Less than 3% offer home births. 0.7% of babies in West Virginia are born at home, one of the lowest rates in the country. For Inside Appalachia and Appalachia Health News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from the Benedum Foundation. As Kara just mentioned, West Virginia currently has one of the lowest home birth rates in the country, while less than 1% of births in America happen at home, according to the CDC. Those numbers are particularly low in Appalachia, but a growing number of women are turning away from hospital births, citing reasons like the desire to control their birth experience, avoid a cesarean, and find a provider who respects their wishes. Over the past 4 months, health reporter Kara Lofton visited some of the families choosing home birth in this region and talked to the midwives who serve them in Kentucky, Ohio, Virginia, and West Virginia. In this detailed report, she looks at both the controversy around home births and why some women are choosing this option despite legal obstacles. Brace yourself. The mother in this story shared her very personal and intimate moments in childbirth with Kara. And it might be a little graphic for some of you.
Jackson, Ohio. The shades are drawn at the house when I arrive, but Marlene, the midwife, must have seen my car lights. She opens the door for me, and we greet each other blearily. By now, it's almost 2 in the morning, and Hannah has been in labor for hours. Hannah is 23. This is her third birth, the first at home. When I first met her, she was 32 weeks pregnant and had agreed to let me shadow Marlene through the rest of her pregnancy and birth. Hannah said her OBGYN considered her pregnancy high risk because her first 2 children had been born by cesarean. She really wanted this third baby to be born vaginally, though. Cesareans are major abdominal surgery and have long recovery times, but said that her OBGYN had told her the hospitals in her region did not allow vaginal births after cesareans, more commonly known as VBACs.
Did you plan on having C-sections the first 2 times?
No, my first one was an emergency C-section, and then she was a repeat. And I planned to have a VBAC with her, and they had said that she was breech, and she ended up being head down, ready to go, whenever I went in for my C-section, so.
Hannah felt misled by her doctors and pushed into an unnecessary second C-section. So for this third baby, Hannah decided she didn't need an OBGYN and found Marlene, a certified professional midwife.
So I wanted something that was more personal, and that's usually what home birth is. That's what it's all about.
It's difficult to know exactly why Hannah couldn't find a physician to assist her in a VBAC. Hannah's OBGYN did not return repeated requests for comment. However, current American College of Obstetric guidelines say that attempting a vaginal birth after cesarean is a safe and appropriate choice for most women who have had prior cesarean delivery, even for some women who have had 2 previous cesareans like Hannah. In other words, a successful vaginal birth is typically safer than a C-section, even for those who have had previous C-sections. But according to Hannah, even attempting a VBAC wasn't an option at her local hospitals, and for her, neither was a repeat C-section. Dr. Dara Aliff, a Charleston-based OBGYN, said that may be because hospitals are required to have 24-hour in-house anesthesia in order for women to attempt to labor after cesarean. If Hannah's hospital did not and an emergency occurred after 5 p.m., she would have to be transferred or she would have to wait for the anesthesia team to return to the hospital. Most small rural hospitals do not have 24-hour in-house anesthesia. In fact, most rural hospitals are closing their obstetric units, forcing rural women who do want hospital births to travel anywhere from 45 minutes to 2 hours to a maternity ward. Hannah would have had to travel 45 minutes to the closest hospital and an hour and a half to the hospital of her choice. So we find ourselves here in her kitchen, where an inflatable birth pool has been set up. Think kiddie pool with warm water. The 2 older children are asleep in their room. Hannah's doing well, but is tired. Her back hurts and nausea comes in waves. From time to time, Marlene listens to the fetal heartbeat or checks on Hannah, but mostly it's just labor. We settle down to wait.
This little boy better look like me.
He won't.
He probably won't.
Look like me, like the other two.
Hannah's midwife, Marlene, is in her late 60s and has been attending births since the early 1970s when she and a couple of friends started to have unassisted births at home.
At first it was just, you had a baby at home, can you help me have a baby at home? And then, well, my friend said you could help them have, and I, for years I said, well, I've read a few books and I've been to a few births, but I'm not a midwife, and so I just helped friends, because back then there wasn't any midwives around, and it was, you had a home birth, you just did it yourself, mostly. So I'd helped a few friends, and then word got around, and then I started working with an OB.
For Marlene, birth is a natural, God-designed process that only occasionally needs medical interventions. She said she relies heavily on faith to decide which births to accept and which are likely not to go well. At a prenatal exam, Marlene brings out a fetal heart monitor. Hannah lies back and pulls up her shirt to expose a 32-week belly. Hannah's youngest, a barely walking toddler, waddles up and mutters unhappily for attention.
There
it is.
Baby.
It's something I believe in. I believe that my care is actually safer than a doctor's care for most people. Not for everybody. There's a time and a place for doctors and hospitals. The European model more relies on midwives to do most of the routine prenatals and births, and they refer to the OB only when they have problems, usually.
In the late 90s, Marlene finally got certified as a professional midwife. By that time, she'd been attending births, both to help friends and as what's called a lay midwife, for more than 20 years. She said the credentialing, which isn't recognized in Ohio anyway, lay midwives are unregulated by the state in both Ohio and West Virginia, did not change the way she practiced, but that some clients like to see letters after their midwife's name.
Our moms are anything from third grade education Schwartz and Trooper Amish to college professors from WKU, and everybody in between.
That's Tracy, a Kentucky-based midwife who asked that I withhold her last name and location because lay midwifery is illegal there.
We've had 98 births this year, or last year, with a 1.5% transfer rate, C-section rate, and that included 3 sets of twins and 3 breeches, but we don't want to use our names. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, it's kind of a messed up system.
What is the fear?
That we'll get a cease and desist to be told that we can't catch babies or hit with a $10,000 fine. And you go against that and you can get jail time. But if I move 15 minutes south to Tennessee, I can get a license.
So here's a good place to briefly talk about midwives and the laws that govern them. There are 3 types of midwives in the United States. First, lay midwives, also known as direct entry midwives, who either learn by trial and error or through an apprenticeship with another lay midwife. Second, certified professional midwives, not all states have the certification, and third, nurse midwives, who usually have a master's or doctorate degree. The types of midwives are regulated differently depending on where they practice. Tennessee, for instance, has a very midwife-friendly climate, with both direct entry and nurse midwives having access to licensure. Kentucky and North Carolina are not so friendly and actively prosecute direct entry midwives. Nurse midwives in Kentucky and North Carolina must be registered as advanced practice nurses. Some states, however, such as West Virginia and Ohio, don't regulate direct entry midwives at all. Midwives such as Marlene like this because it means that they are free to practice the way they want. Public health experts tend to advocate for regulation in these states, though, because without regulation, there's no standard of care. One direct entry midwife could have had extensive training, experience, and expertise, while another is really just Betty from down the block who may have seen a cat give birth once. At this point, you might be wondering, what do physicians have to say about home birth? Well, it depends.
I can't think of a situation where I would say to somebody, gosh, you are just an ideal candidate to do that, because you never know who's going to be the one. Who's going to be the one that all of a sudden isn't. And that can happen quickly.
That's Dara Aliff, a Charleston-based OBGYN. She said her greatest concern with home birth is that no matter the skill or training of the midwife, sometimes a perfectly healthy labor can suddenly go wrong. In those cases, which are a minority, you absolutely want to be at a hospital.
A lot of the women that I talk to, I would say the majority of the women who are doing this, this is not their first birth, and it's a reaction from what they would call a bad hospital experience. So they came in with a birth plan, they felt like they got pushed into being induced, or they got pushed into a cesarean, and they felt like it wasn't medically necessary. And so this is kind of a reaction to, I want to own my birth experience, I want to have control over that experience, and I don't want to be pushed around. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that there are women who are having this experience in hospitals?
Pregnancy is a scary time for women for lots of reasons, but I think the biggest fear and the one that we have the most trouble letting go of is that nobody owns a birth experience. And I think that is where the animosity comes from the medical professionals, because I don't want to do C-sections. I prefer it for my patient to have a vaginal delivery. I love it if they can do it with no medication. That's ideal. That actually, despite some cultural idea that it's easier for us to go in and do a surgery where there's a much higher risk and you get paid like $100 difference from a vaginal delivery to a C-section. So there's no financial incentive to cutting these women.
Actually, to clarify, while Aleph's comment might be true for what she herself earns, a health analytics study published in 2013 found that in the United States, the average total cost of cesarean births was almost $20,000 more expensive than vaginal births.
But I think even when I was pregnant with my own children, it's scary to know nobody's in charge of that. That baby is in charge of that experience.
Aleph says she isn't totally against home births like some of her colleagues, but strongly cautions against what she calls home birth at all costs and urges women to choose their providers carefully. She said that while for many women home birth can go well, for the minority in which something goes desperately wrong, the experience can be hugely traumatic.
I currently have in my practice two women who have documented PTSD from home births gone awry and are seeking care for that. So I think the idea that it can't go wrong just because it's in your house are completely false.
The official viewpoint of the American College of Obstetrics is that hospitals and birthing centers are the safest setting for birth. However, the college respects the right of a woman to make a medically informed decision about delivery. A little data to further muddy the waters. C-section rates for planned home births are almost half that of planned hospital births, according to the Committee on Obstetric Practice. However, planned home births are also associated with a 2 to 3-fold increased risk of neonatal death when compared with planned hospital birth. But remember Hannah? The last time we heard from her, she was still in labor. And trust me, at this point, she doesn't want it to linger any longer than it has to.
Mm-hmm. Keep pushing, babe. Keep pushing. He's right here.
Yeah.
He's right there.
By this point, we are nearing 5 a.m. Hannah has moved out of the birth pool into the shower and now onto the bed. She's pushing.
Look at the top of his head, baby.
Okay. You're doing awesome.
Alrighty. Come on, honey. Come on.
Push, 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 push.
There we go.
He's coming, babe. Push.
You're almost coming.
Once you get past them shoulders, okay, you are good.
Squeeze onto me, honey.
Mm-hmm.
Squeeze me.
There we go. There we go.
There he is.
There you go. Turn him over, sweet.
Matt, Hannah's husband, hands her their son. She holds him on her belly, the cord still attached, and cries softly.
Oh, he's wet. I can't hold him.
Don't lift him up too high.
I got it. There's your boy.
It's short cord.
Whoa.
Marlene barks out orders to the birth photographer, mother-in-law, me, whoever will listen. Normally, Marlene has an assistant to help her in births, but none was available tonight, so she did it solo. Hannah is bleeding onto the pad on the bed. It seems like a lot of blood to me, but Marlene said that while there's a little bit more blood than she likes to see, she isn't concerned yet. She begins working to deliver the placenta. After a few minutes, Hannah looks at Matt.
Do you want to cut the cord? You can.
Yeah, whatever you want me to.
Fix me up a smoothie.
Whatever you want.
It's the energy in me.
The cord is cut. The baby is wrapped in a towel and handed to his grandmother, and Matt helps Hannah into the shower. The birth photographer and I go home. 4 days later, Marlene and I are back for a postpartum visit. Fox is asleep in his mother's arms in a fox-themed onesie.
And his hair kind of looks foxy, doesn't it? Yeah. Just kind of a, I don't know what you'd call it, reddish, but not exactly red. Yeah. It just looks foxy red.
Yeah, there's a fox on her. So now that you're recovering, how do you feel? I mean, you've had two hospital births and two C-sections and one home birth. I mean, how do you, what has the experience been like in retrospect?
Well, like, the recovery is about 1,000 times easier.
Can you explain why that is?
I didn't have, like, major surgery, so I can.
That's a big one.
Yeah, so I can move a lot easier, and, like, the girls are still easier, like, crawling all over me. But I don't have to, like, hold my stomach when I walk, and I don't have to, like, really ask for help, like, lifting my baby up and down like I did with the C-sections.
Matt chimes in from across the room, saying that at this time postpartum with the first two children, he was having to help her get out of bed.
That's crazy.
Like, I had to have help, like, in the shower, like, putting clothes on, like, he had to help me with everything. And this time, you know, I very rarely have to ask him for help, and it's usually help with something that the girls need.
The very first time I met Marlene and Hannah, Marlene made the comment that, quote, "I believe that my care is actually safer than a doctor's care for most people." Almost 3 months later, she clarified what she meant.
One out of every three women that go in the hospital to birth come out with a major abdominal surgery, which is not safer.
In Ohio, those numbers are closer to 31%, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Kentucky and West Virginia's rates are both around 35%.
Home birth rarely has life-threatening complications. And part of that is during our prenatal care, we go over their lifestyle. You know, we make sure there's no street drugs or just junk food in general. Like, we I'm the the green leafy Nazi, and you know, protein and green leafies, and I really stress a good diet and a good exercise lifestyle. You know, chiropractic adjustments to keep your pelvis in alignment, and that's what, like, medical doctors don't ever refer to chiropractors. They want to do it all. And if your pelvis is out of alignment, oh well, you just need to see, you know, you just need more Pitocin to push that baby down harder. And then until that baby goes into distress and you need a C-section, and then the doctor saves you, where a chiropractic adjustment could have saved all that trouble. You know, not that a chiropractic adjustment is the end all of all complications either, but, you know, most complications happen because of doctor interference with the natural process or the mom's lifestyle.
The idea that birth is a natural process and that most complications happen because of a doctor interference is a complaint I heard from almost all the midwives I talked to for this project. On my way out the door after my interview with Dr. Dara Aliff, I asked her what her response was to that viewpoint. She said, well, a burst appendix, or disease, is also a natural process. 100 years ago, someone with a burst appendix would naturally die, but now we interfere so they can live. All sides on the question of where and how to give birth say they just want what's best for the mother and baby. They just don't agree on the what's best part. For Inside Appalachia and Appalachia Health News, I'm Kara Lofton.
So we just heard those very for real moments of a mother giving birth. I mean, whoa, did that really just happen? You know, I think that's pretty amazing that Hannah had not one, but two C-sections, and not only deliver naturally, but deliver her third baby at home. Now that's inspiring to me. And it's also pretty inspiring that Kara traveled in the middle of the night to make sure she was there to record this birth. So I asked her onto the show to talk about what it was like to work on this long-term report about midwifery. So you've been studying midwifery in Appalachia for a few months now. What would you say is your main takeaway from this experience?
I think the main takeaway that I found is that women are choosing home birth for a variety of different reasons, but probably the one that was the most consistent throughout this project was that women are wanting to own their birth experience or have more control over how they interact with their bodies, their physicians, their care provider, and they don't want to be pushed into what they perceive as unnecessary medical interventions, whether that be a C-section or induction or an IV antibiotic. They really want to have a natural birth experience, especially if they are low risk and have had what they perceive as a bad hospital experience for a previous pregnancy.
I think this is really interesting, and I'm glad we can share it with our listeners to let them know that they do have options. And you were there for a live birth. I mean, did you ever think that would happen? What was that like?
It took me a long time to find a mother who would let me follow her through the last trimester of her pregnancy and come to the birth, because it was a super intimate request. And it was a really intense experience. I got a call around midnight. I got there a little after 2 a.m. The baby was born around 5:30 in the morning. It was just the midwife, the father, the mother, and the mother-in-law and a birth photographer. So it's, you know, a really small group of people. Everybody was pitching in. But really this idea that it was a very intimate experience, and the midwife did not really do that much except support the mother when needed. She definitely stepped in and performed procedures like delivering the placenta, but for the most part, it was coaching the mother on what to do when, and supporting her through what they considered the natural process of giving birth.
And I guess it's important to fit the right midwife with the right mother.
Yeah, I would definitely say so. As a woman of childbearing age, it was very interesting to talk with these midwives, because I felt like I could almost interview them in a way in terms of what I would want for myself. So in a way saying, prove yourself to me. Like, what if I'm going to have a child anytime in the near future, you know, the next 5 to 10 years, why would I choose you? And I think it is super important, whether you choose an OBGYN or a nurse midwife in a hospital or a midwife in a birthing center or a home birth, that you feel comfortable with the relationship you have with your provider. And that's why a lot of the women did choose to go to the home birth setting. They felt very pushed around by their medical provider in a hospital setting. The downside is that because there are so few midwives, and because midwives are unregulated in West Virginia and in Ohio and in Kentucky, for that matter, direct entry midwives, that is, you are going to have a varying degree of standard of care. Some women are going to be super experienced and great midwives at what they do, and others will really not have a lot of experience.
Well, I'm really thankful that you made the trip and you were able to bring this story to Inside Appalachia. Kara Lofton, Appalachia Health News Coordinator, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, to all my ladies out there who had cesareans, we stand with you too. Both of my children came into this world that way. My first baby came after an emergency cesarean, this after trying to be induced. My second child came with a scheduled C-section because, well, I was pretty much convinced I'd die if I didn't do it. So, while midwifery in rugged rural places in Appalachia was once a necessity, more mothers seem to be looking to home births as a way to find comfort and courage in the birth of their children. But like we learned before, there are risks. The bottom line is that it's a decision that the mother, the woman, has to make and should be respected. Till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Michael Howard, David Munford, Anna and Elizabeth, Little Sparrow, Andrea Tomasi, and Tom Briding. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our show this week was edited by Glennis Board and Suzanne Higgins. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.